is most people that don't believe in Christianity have all these reasons they don't believe, but a lot of those reasons they haven't thought about or doubted in a while. So they know the reasons they don't believe. They don't necessarily trust the case for Christianity, but then in this case against Christianity, the objections, they've sat with them for so long, they've become so comfortable with their doubts that their doubts have become sort of a set of alternative beliefs almost. Their doubts are now articles of faith. And the point of this series is to get you to doubt your doubts, to get you to question these objections that you've been comfortable with for so long, and to show, hopefully, I mean, if we succeed, to show that the case against Christianity isn't quite as strong as you've come to believe it is. So what we said last week is, even if we succeed, even if we accomplish that, this series in and of itself isn't going to make anybody a believer, because you know we're not making a positive case for Christianity. We do that in other series at other times. We're just attacking the negative case. So at best, really, all we can do is kind of make everybody more confused, you know, and kind of restore you to a disoriented place of not knowing what you think. And if we do that, then I will consider this series a huge success. This morning, it's the second objection. Last week, we talked about this objection of exclusivity and arrogance. You know, how can Christianity claim to be the one true religion? This morning, we're coming to the second objection, which I've called moral inferiority. And it basically goes like this. Hasn't the church done a lot of really messed up things throughout history? Isn't there a lot of blood on the church's hands? Isn't there a lot of stuff that the church has done that's pretty morally iffy? And, you know, going from the institutional level to the individual level, forget about, you know, history and society and all that. Just focusing on, you know, the people I know, personal experience, I can tell you that some of the worst people I know are so-called Christians. So my least favorite people claim to be Christians. So isn't that in and of itself an argument against Christianity? Isn't that kind of off somehow? I mean, if this is true, if there's something to this, if this is supposed to be from God, doesn't that seem a little bit wrong that should be the case? So I want to address that this morning, and I actually want to address it by breaking it down into two separate different charges that are related but a little bit different. There's actually the objection that I just mentioned, as I said, there's a kind of a stronger form of it and a weaker form of it. Not stronger and weaker in terms of how likely they are to be true, but just in terms of how much they're asserting. So the stronger form of this objection is actually that religion makes people worse. That it's an evil. It's a source of evil in itself. That there are things intrinsic to religion that, when combined with human nature, are bad and make people do bad things that they wouldn't do otherwise. This is the Christopher Hitchens view: religion poisons everything. I want to talk about that first, the stronger view that religion actually makes people worse. And then after we talk about that, the second section of the message will be the somewhat weaker, probably more reasonable view that, well, look, I don't know if it makes people worse or not. I don't know if it's bad, but I just don't think it makes people any better. You know, people that are Christians aren't necessarily any better than people that aren't. And so in the first section, we're going to focus more on kind of big picture society, the church as an institution, when we're talking about the strong claim, does religion make people worse? And then in the second section, when we're just asking, does it make people any better or not, we're going to focus more on individual people. So that's the outline. I'm afraid this might get a little disorganized at points. I'll admit that I had a tough time with this one this week. There's a lot of stuff that I wanted to fit in here that I wasn't able to fit in, but that may accidentally get fit in while I'm talking. Apologies up front. If it starts to go significantly longer than usual, someone that knows me well maybe just kind of, you know, wave and say we're done. Let's hope for the best. First, the stronger claim that religion actually is a source of evil, that it makes people do bad things. And again, here in this one, we're focusing more on society as a whole, more on the church as an institution. So what do people have in mind when they say this? I think they're thinking of these, you know, atrocities that have been committed in the name of God throughout history. So if you look at Christian history, the first two that people will often mention are the Crusades in the Middle Ages is always the first one that people say. And then the Inquisition, also in the Middle Ages. The Crusades, these religious wars between Muslims and Christians, and sponsored by the church, you know, supported by the church. And then the Inquisition, this period in the 1400s in Spain, where they wanted to do kind of some cleaning up of the doctrine, so they would call people in that they thought said they were Christians but weren't really Christians. So it's kind of like a McCarthyism type thing. And there was some torture, there was some executions, there was some imprisonment. Those are the first two they get mentioned. But then after that, after the big two, there's the witch hunts in Europe. You know, over about 300 years, probably 300,000 people were killed, mostly women. There is missionary imperialism often gets talked about here. So people go into other countries to spread the gospel, but really they end up just taking the land and imposing their cultural values. And then there's just kind of this general divisiveness that religion causes that can kind of cause people to come to blows over doctrinal issues. So Christian on Christian violence is a big one here with Protestantism and Catholicism. People talk about all the wars that happened after the Reformation, and obviously Protestant Catholic violence continues up until, you know, recently in Northern Ireland. So it's a pretty bad list. I mean, I don't want to say that it's not. And when you look at all that together, some people have made the claim, well, come on, religion actually then, forget about whether it makes people better or not, it's a source of evil. It makes the world a worse place. We'd be better off if there were no religion at all. So a couple of responses to this, three things in particular that I want to say. The first thing is, and I don't mean to minimize all of what we just talked about anyway by saying this, but the first thing is this charge does majorly get trumped up beyond kind of the facts pretty often. So you will hear it said that, you will hear people throw it out there, that religion actually is the number one source of wars in world history. Or, George Carlin in his Ten Commandments routine says, to thunderous applause, more people have been killed in the name of God than for any other reason. You know, people go nuts. And, I hate to disparage the great George Carlin, but that's just false. That's just plainly false. It's almost crazy. You can refute that very quickly with three names alone. Hitler, Stalin, Mao. Just right there, these atheistic totalitarian regimes of the 20th century have a higher body count than, no question, than all these religious wars or atrocities combined. And the truth is, atheistic regimes and secularism has been a far, far more devastating problem for humans in terms of violence than any religion. Christianity, Islam, it doesn't matter. Because, as Dostoevsky famously says, if God is not, anything is permissible. If God is not, anything is permissible. And there have been all sorts of very well-intentioned and probably very well-informed attempts by philosophers to ground morality in something other than God. You know, I mean, the thing that makes an atheist more irritated than anything else is if you say, well, without God, there's no morality. They hate that because atheists are often very moral people, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. So there are all sorts of arguments out there about why you should be a moral person even if there's not a God. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is nobody has to listen to those arguments. If there's no God, you're just a person, I'm just a person, and you may have a good reason to be moral, but at the end of the day, there's no authority behind it. And that's why atheistic regimes, secularism, has been by far the greatest source of evil and violence and killing in the history of mankind. So that's the first thing that needs to be said, is that the charges get trumped up, and there's absolutely no basis for saying that somehow Christianity or religions have been the number one source of violence and evil, or that we'd somehow be better off without them. You know, this is the John Lennon song everybody knows from 1971, Imagine There's No Heaven, no religion to, you know, think of all the people living life in peace. Think of all the people living for today. You may see, I'm a dreamer, I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will be one. You know, this utopia of the world without religion, and it's crazy because we've already seen that. We've already seen what that would look like in the 20th century, and it's awful. It's really awful. That's the first thing, that these charges get really trumped up. The second thing that needs to be said is Christianity and religion, but Christianity in particular, have been the greatest. Not only are they not the greatest source of evil or wars or division, but they've been the greatest mitigator of evil and the greatest source of good in human history. And to prove that, you know, that Christianity and that religion actually restrains evil, we could talk about, you know, a big historical example or societal example or something, but what I'd rather do is just talk about a very small scale example that I think proves the point even better. So what I've always wanted to ask these guys, you know, these famous atheist guys that have written these books the last 10 years about how religion's actually the worst thing that's ever happened and makes people worse, is, okay, so if you, let's do a thought experiment and say that you find yourself in some really rough section of the Bronx at like 11 o'clock at night, you're all alone, and you're walking down a totally empty street, and all of a sudden around the corner comes this group of 8 or 9 guys in their late teens, early 20s, and, you know, they're not particularly well-dressed, look to be from the neighborhood. And the question is, would you feel any differently at that moment if you found out that those guys were all coming from a Bible study that they had just been at? Would that affect your perception of the events at all? And the truth is, of course it would. Of course, at that moment, you'd breathe a sigh of relief. Oh, okay, these are good guys. These are good guys. Christianity restrains evil. Religion restrains evil. That's what we were talking about with the atheistic regimes. And it's this incredible source of cultural good, you know, these goods that everybody acknowledges. So Christopher Hitchens in his book talks about, we don't need the Bible. All we need is Western literature. That can be our Bible. Western literature is based on the Bible. Everything we have that's great in Western literature comes from the Bible, is drawing on scriptural themes. He even mentions Dostoevsky specifically as one of his kind of canonical writers, who's just a devout Christian through and through. It doesn't make sense. And all the beauty, all the art, all the truth, so much of the philosophy, it's so hard to separate anything good that has come out of Western society from Christianity. It's very, very hard to divide those things because they're so intimately intertwined. So that's the second thing, is that Christianity is the greatest mitigator of evil. Religion, even in general, is the greatest mitigator of evil in the world, and it's this remarkable source of good. Those two things aside, you know, first we said, okay, the charges are trumped up. Second, we said, okay, it's a source of good and it's a mitigator of evil. Those two things aside, what is left of this objection that religion is actually something that makes people do bad things? Is there anything to it? And the answer to that is, yeah, I think there is. I think there is still a core that's left intact to this objection about religion making people worse or making people do bad things. But what I want to say third, and probably most importantly in this section, is that the most angry and caustic and original, insightful, and piercing critic of religion that's ever lived, by far, is Jesus Christ. No question. The most piercing critic of religion that's ever lived is Jesus Christ. And every criticism of religion that's been made was made first by Christ. So if you think about the things that people say, like, well, these doctrinal differences, you know, they make people condemn those that believe differently than they do. Jesus said that. This is the point of the passage, today's passage, by the way, the passage you heard read earlier where Jesus is talking with the Pharisees. He's just going through this litany of all these charges that people make today against religion. So you think about the witch hunts. Jesus condemns that sort of thing with the woman caught in adultery, where they come and they want to stone this woman, and he says, well, you know, whichever one of you is without sin, why don't you throw the first stone. And it's just like that over and over, all his stories. The Good Samaritan, he chooses a Samaritan because the Samaritan is heterodox. The Samaritan has the wrong beliefs. And he says, look at the moral superiority of the person that has the wrong beliefs. You know, what does that do to you? Or missionary imperialism. You heard it read in the passage. He says to the Pharisees, you cross land and sea to go make a convert, and then you make that convert twice the son of hell that you are. He doesn't mince words. He's very sharp critic of religion and religiosity, religulosity, as Bill Maher would say. He's very upset about the ways that religion can become a source of corruption and a source of dividing people. The other things that you heard mentioned there in the passage, he talks about the tendency of religious people to focus on really small ritual concerns while ignoring really important moral concerns. So he says, you go to your herb garden and you make sure to tithe, you know, give a tenth of each of your herbs to the church, but then you're oppressing the poor at the same time. That makes a lot of sense. He talks about the tendency of religious people to use ritual moral purity as a smokescreen for moral impurity. He talks about the tendency to load down those, you know, under your care. So he's always on the Pharisees about this. Load down with all these burdens, these moral burdens that nobody can lift, as a way of kind of gaining power and authority for yourself. The sharpest critic of religion that's ever lived is Christ. And so then the question is, what's the answer? These real, actual problems that religion does cause in the heart. What's the answer to those? Is it less religion? Well, no, because then, you know, like we said, religion is the greatest mitigator of evil in the world, and it's the greatest source of good in the world. So the answer is not less religion. The answer is different religion, or a different sort of religion. And that's what Jesus came. That's what Jesus came to bring, was this different sort of religion. Because all of the problems of traditional religion stem from the fact that it's performance-based. That you are doing these things, you are earning God's approval, you are better than other people, and so therefore you have a right to look down on them. Therefore you have a right to tell them what to do, or to tell them what to think, or to impose yourself on them. And Jesus upends that. Jesus upends traditional religion by coming and saying, it's not about you performing, it's not about you earning God's approval, it's not about you proving to everybody else how good you are. I'm going to die, I'm going to be raised again, and then a connection with God is through me. So then everybody is on level footing at that point. You know, nobody has a leg up on anybody else. And in doing that, in upending traditional religion, he solves all these problems that religion has a tendency to create in the human heart. So that's the first section. I'm not totally satisfied with that, you know, and so if you're not either, that's okay. This is a big topic, and there are about four sermons in here that we don't have time for this morning. But the first section is, does religion make people worse? And the answer is, even after all the qualifications, yeah, in some contexts it does. It does make people worse. But the answer to that, the solution to that isn't necessarily less religion, but a different kind of religion, the kind that Jesus brings. The second section, putting aside now this stronger objection about does religion make the world a worse place, the second objection, which I think is probably a little easier to grasp and probably resonates with more people, is, okay, so forget all that. What about just regular people? You know, forget history and wars and violence, just regular the people that I know. Why doesn't Christianity make regular people better than the people that don't believe it? You know, the people that do believe it better than the people that don't. Because we can admit that it doesn't necessarily, you know. So just take me as an example. I mean, there's probably a better standard bearer for the Christian faith than me. But just assuming that I'm average, you know, and I would not necessarily want to go head-to-head with just your average secular person in this city on a contest of morality, you know, or character, let's say, character. There are plenty of, I guarantee you, non-believing people in this city, people that don't believe in God, that are a lot more patient than I am, a lot kinder than I am, more generous than I am, spend more time doing good things that for other people than I do, more emotionally secure than I am, more mature than I am in all these other ways. And the question is, well, doesn't that cut against Christianity in some sense? Because if people who aren't Christians are better people often, or just as good as people that are, then what good is Christianity anyways? What does it do? What is it for? So I think there's something very legitimate about this objection, but then there's also a bunch of reasons why it doesn't make sense. So first, the legitimate part is, if Christianity doesn't make any difference to a person's life, then I do agree with the objector that we can kind of discard it. If a person is forever just as selfish and greedy and spiteful after they become a Christian as they were before they were a Christian, then I do agree that it is a serious strike against Christianity. It's legitimate to judge Christianity by its results in that sense. And Jesus told us to do as much. Jesus says, you know, you judge a tree by its fruit. So that part of it is legitimate. If that's what the objection means, looking at one life, that's very legitimate, and I agree. What's not legitimate, what's not reasonable to expect, is that all Christians as a class should be more moral or have better character than all non-Christians, all non-believing people as a class. That doesn't make sense for a couple of reasons. First reason it doesn't make sense is it's a vast oversimplification of how the world actually is. It's way too hard to actually divide the human population into Christians over here and everybody else over here. I mean, for one thing, there's people that call themselves Christians and are on their way out the door. You know, they're ceasing to become Christians day by day. There's some pastors in that category. For another thing, there's people that don't call themselves Christians but are headed in that direction. Then there's people who are decidedly not Christians, but for whatever reason are obsessed with Jesus. So Gandhi would fit into this category. Obviously not a Christian, a severe critic of Christianity, and yet studied the life of Christ more than I ever will, more than I could in three lifetimes, obsessed with Jesus, tried to emulate Jesus. So which category does he go in? You know, does he count on the not a Christian side or the Christian side? And there's just everybody's, you know, there's people that have all these jumbled together beliefs, and they call themselves, they may call themselves a Christian or they may not, but they've got all these different belief systems that are conflicting. So it's going to be too hard to just kind of, in these mass categories, compare the Christians to the non-Christians. And you say, well, okay, so why can't we just take two individuals then? Just take, you know, and I'm sure everybody could think of people like this in their lives. Just take, you know, my atheist friend over here, who's a really cool person, and my Christian friend over here who's not such a cool person. You know, and I know both of them pretty well, actually. Why if we take two real people that we actually know and compare them to each other, why can't that be kind of a argument against Christianity, that this person's so much better, nicer, more fun to be around than this other person? Doesn't that disprove the truth of Christianity? And I don't think it does, and the reason I don't think it does is because looking at it that way ignores this really important piece of where people start in life. So the example that C.S. Lewis uses, which I think it's kind of silly, but I think it's helpful, is so if you think about whitening toothpaste, the goal of whitening toothpaste is for the person who uses it to make their teeth whiter than when they started. And if it does that, you'd say it works. But what would be totally unreasonable is to take a person who's using the whitening toothpaste and compare them to a person who's not using it but has naturally whiter teeth and say, well, look, the toothpaste doesn't work. You know, this person has whiter teeth and they don't use the toothpaste. So clearly it doesn't work. And it's a good example because it's pointing to the fact that people start in different places in life. There are these natural inequalities, and that has to do that comes to play with our character and with our morality too. You know, it's how you were raised, it's the family you grew up in, it's the experiences you had, it's genetics. And somebody who grows up in this really difficult environment, you know, with these really difficult relationships, and just kind of gets a really rough start, whether they become a Christian or not, they're going to compare unfavorably to this person who's had every advantage in life. That's just the way it is. That's just how the world works. And the question isn't whether they're, you know, nicer or meaner than the guy that's not a Christian. The question is, are they nicer than they would have been? Are they nicer compared to themselves, compared only to themselves, than you know, how mean, how awful might they have been if they weren't a Christian? I mean, that's the question I ask myself. is I honestly am disappointed at times with the kind of moral and character development progress that I've made up to this point in my life. I look at myself and think, man, you know, if God is really in my life, shouldn't I be further along than this? But then I think, well, what might I have been like without God? You know, how much more of a jerk might I be if I didn't have God in my life? And that's the question to ask. And the same question to your atheist person that's this great person. How much nicer, how much better might they be if they did have God in their life? It's comparing apples and oranges to compare any two people to each other. Every person is so distinct and unique and has their own story. It's just not fair. You can't do it. You can only compare the person to him or herself and what he or she would have been otherwise. So then that leads to the third thing I want to say on this, which is when you think about that, when you think about the different starting places, what it actually starts to, you start to realize is that this objection that, well, shouldn't Christians be better than the non-Christians on average, taking into account the different starting places in life part, it actually suggested that it should be just the opposite. It points in a totally different direction. It points in the direction that we should probably expect Christians to be a little bit less well-developed in terms of their character and morality than non-Christians. And here's why. Think about the whitening toothpaste. Who's going to buy the whitening toothpaste? The person that already has these brilliant teeth, or the person that needs a little bit of help in that department? It's going to appeal the most to the person that has the most to gain from it and the person that's kind of lowest on the scale. And that's clearly true with Christianity as well. You know, here's the central message of Christianity. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter who your parents are. It doesn't matter how you failed. Jesus died for your sins. You're accepted. You're forgiven. God is your father too, and he's calling you home. Who's that going to appeal to? Not the people from good families. Not the people who had good educations. It's going to appeal to the people on the bottom. It's going to appeal to the people who had the worst start, who need the most forgiveness. And if that's true, and they come into the church, and transformation doesn't happen immediately, because it doesn't, it takes a long time, then that's going to take the average morality score of the church way down. Way down. And it's supposed to be that way. It's that way by design. Eugene Peterson, the pastor and professor, the guy who paraphrased the message paraphrase, says this mistake is like when it's like people thinking that the church is a health club where you're going to go in and see all these, you know, ripped bodybuilders that are there all the time working out. And really, it's not a health club. It's a hospital. It's not a health club. It's a hospital for sick people. And so if you realize that, then this objection is almost laughably absurd. It's like you walk into a hospital and say, wow, this hospital is a joke. You know, look, all these people are sick. I mean, they're sicker than the average person on the street. Like, I'm never going to go to a hospital. It's just sick people in here. This is helping nobody. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. If the church is a hospital for sinners, then of course Christians are going to be worse off morally than a lot of people outside the church. But so then this is the last thing I'll say. Then the question is, well, so if I am a generally moral person, then you're saying I don't need the church? You know, is that basically, are you saying that Christianity is just remedial? But it's only for people who kind of need a leg up, and for people that have had natural advantages and have been kind of given, you know, a good family and good genes and whatever else, that they don't need Christianity. It's just kind of to bring the lower ranks up to par. Is that what you're saying? No, it's not what I'm saying. What I want to say to those of you who kind of are good people, naturally, who are, you know, virtue comes easier to you at least than the average person, is that you don't have to come into this hospital of Christianity unless you want to get close to God. And if you do want to get close to God, you do have to come in, because this is where God hangs out. But that is a barrier. I get that that's a barrier, and it was a barrier when Christ was on earth. There's all sorts of good, upstanding citizens that would have loved to hang around Jesus when he was on earth, except for the company that Jesus kept, except for all these people around Jesus that were just the total lowlifes. And so people have always said from day one of Christianity, well, if there was anything to it, I know those people wouldn't be involved with it. You know, it clearly can't be the truth because look who's coming around. There's lots of people who would have loved to be around Jesus, but they couldn't tolerate the company he kept. But it was like that then, and it's like that now. If you want to get close to God, you have to come into the church where all the crazies are. You have to come and be around these people who you previously would have kind of looked down on. And the reason for that is, so you just say, well, why? You know, I mean, if you take your hospital example, why does a person who's well need to go to the hospital? That doesn't make any sense. The reason is that, you know, what we've been talking about, which to us looks like this huge scale from like the really screwed up immoral people over here to the really morally exemplary people over here. So it looks like us, this to us. And in reality, this, you know, in God's eyesight, it's like this. These are so close together. They're barely indistinguishable. I mean, they're distinguishable. There's just like a razor thin margin between the very best things human beings do on their own and the very worst things that human beings do on their own. And it looks like this huge gap to us. But the design is, so, you know, the offer's put out there. This is what Christianity is. Forgiveness for everybody through Christ. Doesn't matter what you've done. And all the people that are really bad flock to it. But if you can get over your pride, the people that are really good, what happens to them is if they come around and they start hanging out with these other people, they realize, oh, wait a minute, I'm no different. Wait a minute. These things that I thought they did that were so bad that I could never do, now that I know them, I can see myself easily doing that. And once you take into account the fact that the thoughts count too, that emotions count too, you know, I mean, how are you going to draw this line? How are you going to say that you're not sick? You might not think you are. You might not think you need a hospital. But it's just really a matter of coming to figure out that you're just as sick as they are. So in some ways, you have a longer path. In some ways, it's harder for you. That's something we've talked about before on Sundays. It's harder in some ways for good people because they have to get over their goodness first to realize how much they need it. But in the end, you're in the same position they are. You're in the same position they are of needing this forgiveness just as much. I don't know if that's, if we really answered it or not. Again, I did struggle with this one, and I hope you'll continue to struggle with it too. Like I said, the point of this series is kind of to make us all a little bit more confused. But I do think, just to sum up, that there's some unique things about Christianity, and those unique things about Christianity versus other religions and versus secular philosophies have a pretty powerful way of answering these objections. First, that, you know, that religion does bad things to people. Well, that may be true of traditional religion, but not Jesus' religion. And second, that Christians aren't as good as secular people, and which Christianity says, so what? You know, isn't that exactly what we should expect? So take it for what you will, do with it what you want, and next week we'll move on to the third objection. Let's pray. God, we know that you want us to be good people, loving people, people that promote peace and justice and harmony, and people that help others and people that are kind and all of these things. We know that you want that, and we pray that you'd make us more that way. But we also know that more important to you even than those things is that we realize that we need you, that we realize that we aren't sufficient on our own, that we can't be what you want without your help. And so I pray, God, this morning, first for those that have already realized that they're never going to be these great people on their own. I pray that you'd come and speak to them and comfort them and let them know that that's okay, and draw them to you and to your forgiveness. And I pray also, and secondly, for those that still kind of are claiming in pride to their own moral record, I ask that you would convict them. I ask that you'd show them how little separates them from those who they think are beneath them and worse than them. I ask that you would, even if it's painful, God, that you would kind of demolish this this edifice that they've built up of their own goodness and niceness and achievement, and help them to see with new eyes that they need you just as much as anybody else does. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.